You're listening to 830 AM KSDP in Sandpoint, Alaska, K201DA in King Cove, Alaska.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. My guests today are Lael Wilcox and Rue Calladite. Lael is an ultra-endurance bike rider and racer. Her many accomplishments include fastest known times on routes around the world. She has many first place woman finishes and also some overall first place finishes in ultra endurance bike races, including first place overall in the 2016 Trans Am bike race. Most recently, she broke the Women's Guinness Around the World bike record. Rue, Lael's wife, is a professional photographer. She plays a behind the scenes yet vitally important part of the team, supporting Lael's rides and documenting the journey. Keep listening for more on Outdoor Explorer.
You're listening to Alaska Public Media on KSKA Anchorage, FM 91.1.
Experience true stories, told live without notes, at the Moth Main Stage. When the moth migrates to Anchorage each year, the audience will laugh, cry, and bond with a theater full of strangers, reflecting that the shortest distance between two people is a story. Thursday, February 20th in the Atwood Concert Hall. Tickets to the Moth Main Stage available at CenterTix and AnchorageConcerts.org. This message sponsored by Anchorage Concert Association.
This is Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. With me today is Lael Wilcox and Rue Calladite. Lael should be a very familiar name to all Alaskans. She just set an around-the-world record on her bike. Rue is Lael's wife and a professional photographer. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us, Lisa.
I really want you to let everybody know where you are right now and how you're recording this, because we would be a little jealous on this November day in Alaska where it's a typical overcast November day.
Yeah, totally. So we are home in Tucson, Arizona, and it's 76 degrees and it's actually cloudy, which is pretty unusual here, but really, really lovely. So we're just sitting outside out front so you can kind of hear some bird sound. Sometimes the neighbor dogs kind of go off and there might be a few cars passing.
It looks like a really great place to have an interview.
Yeah, I try to do most of my calls out front here because I think, great. Well, I'm in front of a screen, but at least I'm still sitting outside.
Absolutely. I was looking back at the last time we chatted on Outdoor Explorer, and it was 2019. That was the last time I interviewed you. It was, I can't believe, 5 years ago.
That's amazing. Time has been flying.
It really has. And you've done so much. You did so much before that, and you're doing so much since then. And I think that I tried to schedule an interview like in 2022, and the two of you were in Bosnia.
Yeah, totally.
Make it work because of the time change and you were really busy riding. And what were you doing in Bosnia?
That year I was, oh man, I did the most different races on different continents in one summer. I think it was like seven races that season. And that one was the Trans-Balkan race. And it was a mountain bike race that went through the Balkans from Slovenia to Montenegro. And then right after that, we flew to Kenya for migration gravel. And after that, we went to Iceland for the West Fjords Challenge.
Wow, amazing.
By the end of the year, I was so smoked. And I kind of reframed from there. I was like, never again. So that kind of led me to this year. I was like, around the world. Well, it might be hitting all these places, but at least it's one continuous ride. So that actually felt easier and less stressful than previous seasons, which is crazy.
Because before you were just like jumping from country to country, having to fly and everything, right? And this time you're just like, get someplace where you can ride for thousands of miles before you have to get on a plane.
Yeah, exactly. And this one, I tried to make it more sustainable. I slept 7 hours a night. I ate real meals. And I was just, you know, kind of focused on one thing. In the past, it's, you know, sleeping 2 hours a night and eating food from the gas stations.
Yeah, yeah.
This
we will definitely talk more about that for sure. Let's just refresh everybody on your backstory, just kind of how you got into endurance biking. And, you know, you're an Anchorage kid, which is just so thrilling, beyond thrilling. to see you get all this international attention and know that your family and your base is still here is really cool. So, you know, you and I have known each other since you were in high school, because I coached you in high school, which, you know, you were always that kid who had to go do more. So this all made sense to me when you found this. And of course, you drove me crazy as a coach, because you're like, no, you're only doing a 2 mile. But you had that drive always to do more, and it really filled your cup.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I always wanted to run farther. And even right out of high school, I ran the marathon.
It was like a day after the state meet or something like that. It was really close to the state meet, I remember.
No, but somehow that was like the, you know, I just had to do the farthest I possibly could do. But I didn't even know stuff like traveling by bike existed, or that I could race across the country or, you know, around the world. I didn't even know people traveled by bike.
Yeah.
You know, I was a runner, and that's what I loved most. But I think I really started riding long because I got injured. And I couldn't run. And that was just so mentally and emotionally frustrating that I started borrowing my mom's road bike and riding as far as I could on my days off of work.
Oh, wow. And what kind of, did she have a good road bike?
I thought, this is the nicest bike I've ever ridden. And it was like a Specialized Ruby, probably like a $3,000 bike, a nice bike, carbon fiber bike, pretty light. And then, I mean, I think I rode that thing into the ground.
Wow. Do you still have that somewhere on a wall or anything?
My mom does, and she's still riding it. She put a stem riser on it, and she's still riding it. It's down here, I think, in Tucson. My folks just got a small place here. So I have them close by, which is
That's so great. That's so really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you left high school, you went to college in at UPS, right?
That's right.
University of Puget Sound. And you, at that point, you weren't driving. And I don't know, that's the other question I have for you. Do you drive now, or do you still not drive?
I still don't. But you know what? I got an e-bike, and I put these bucket panniers on it, and Rue calls that my car.
Yeah. Close enough.
I love it. It's so good. But I'm still not driving. But, you know, at this point, I think it's probably not going to happen. I'm 38. I can't believe it.
You can still learn new skills.
Yeah.
It'd be a lot of work, though. Rue, you drive, right?
I'm the driver. Yes.
Okay.
Happy to do it, too.
That's great. So in 2008 was when you kind of started your bike touring career. And you were just going out recreationally, right? And spending, I remember this time in your life, because I was talking to you at that point. I would run into you, and you were talking about, like, you know, just working half time in Anchorage, and then the other 6 months you were gone on your bike.
Yeah, exactly. And that was for 7 years. And it wasn't only Anchorage. I ended up basically anywhere I'd end a bike trip, I'd just get a job and save money and then go on the next one. So Key West, Florida, Albuquerque, New Mexico, Annapolis, Maryland, Tacoma, Washington, where I went to school. And it just felt so free, but I didn't think it would continue. I'd go on one trip and kind of be over it and move on. And then somehow it just kept being exciting, you know, and there were new places to go and places I was interested in. And I also really liked how simple the life was, you know. It's like, I just had what I carried on the bike, and I was camping, sleeping outside most nights, and basically kept my expenses pretty low. You know, I didn't even have a phone.
Yeah. I remember seeing that in one of your videos or something, that you didn't have a phone, and that's just crazy.
Now, you know, and it's I do everything on the phone, but it was just different. And that it felt like that pace was so nice, especially after, you know, finishing college, and that was so stressful. So I think it was just like a refresh and an adventure, a way to kind of learn about the world before I did something else. And then I guess the next thing I did was just starting to race, you know, because this was just kind of biking just to see places. And, you know, I rode maybe like 50 miles a day, pretty manageable. But it did take me to all these really remote spots, and I just got so kind of invested in that. And then it was during one of these trips that I entered my first race, and then realized it was something I really loved and something I was good at, because it kind of changed things for me. Riding the bike just at kind of a slow pace wasn't as exciting. I had kind of forgotten that piece of, you know, loving to be an athlete and to push myself and to compete. And I wasn't really doing that. And then when I started racing, it all kind of clicked. I was like, oh yeah, I can really get my heart rate up. I can do things I think are impossible. And then because it's, you know, ultra long distance, it would take multiple days. And something about that was so exciting because I did it. I wouldn't know how it was going to go. You know, mm-hmm. I couldn't predict like how things would change 3 days later, 5 days later, what would happen with the weather. And also the idea of competition and something like that is just totally different. You know, it's like you have to deal with all these unexpected things and, you know, solve problems and just keep moving forward. And everything you get to see while you do that is pretty incredible.
That first race you did was kind of, you kind of stumbled upon it, right? You were, what country were you in?
Yeah, I was traveling in Israel.
Okay.
And I actually was at that point using these long distance race routes as touring routes because I thought, oh, if somebody put all this effort into crafting this nice track across their country, it's probably pretty good. So I was just following this route and it went through the desert in Israel and then the old city of Jerusalem and then up in the hills, like along the Mediterranean and then up in the hills in the north. And I thought, oh, this is a really cool route. I realized I'd be there for the race. And so I just entered the race kind of on a whim. And that was, you know, I showed up in like my tennis shoes and my junky bike. The only woman. And it was, I had nothing to lose. You know, I just was crazy.
So when you showed up at that race, because you talk about this later about some of the pushback sometimes you get at start lines, not from women, but from men, to be honest. Was there any pushback from the men at the start of that race?
I mean, I think they were just like, what is she doing here? You know, because I wasn't even wearing like a bike outfit. I was wearing like a cotton t-shirt and running shoes. And so I think they were surprised because these guys were like super serious, you know, had the right outfit and a really nice bike. But I had so much experience from living on my bike. Of course, I was more ready to do this. You know, these guys had never like slept outside like that, carrying everything they needed. So I think I was actually like in pretty good shape for it. And then the cool thing that happened was it, especially in Israel at that time, you know, it was like women were thought of as equals intellectually, but not really as athletes. They just, that wasn't part of the culture for them to go out and do these kind of athletic achievements. So when I was like winning this whole race and I was the only woman in a field of like 40 other men, they were just shocked, you know, they couldn't believe that was happening. And then these women came out and would find me because I had a tracker so they could see my location and they found me after the race and they would just kind of well up in tears because it meant so much to them that a woman showed that this was possible. I thought that is so cool. You know, like that's such a, and I mean, yeah, you're always coming kind of at a disadvantage as a woman into sports, but it's also like you also get the chance to be the underdog and then go win.
Yeah.
You know? And it's a bigger deal because it proves like women can do this kind of thing. Feel like I've been doing this, you know, for like 10 years and we still aren't seeing like the participation really rise, which I'm like, it really should be, you know,
which I was going to ask you if you've followed that race and if you've seen if there have been any women since you've done it or has there been a growth in women
really
doing
followed it? That race, but I've been following the sport and the cool thing is like more events are growing and that's because there's so much passion in this sport right now that people are making different races in all these different countries. And I am seeing more women participate, but usually in the field, it's 10% or less. And then it's a really big deal if a race makes a big push and gets like a 50-50 field. That's huge. And that's really cool to see. And some of them are. I'm going to do a race across Europe next year. And their goal is to have 100 women at the start line. So that would be like a third of the field. And that.
Oh, wow.
Cooler because you know when that actually happens you look around and you see like women of all ages, sizes, abilities and I think that's so much more powerful because you know each of those women are heroes to different communities, to their friends and their families and that actually makes a difference. They do this hard thing and then they go home and share that story and then you see that kind of spread like fire, you know, to see that happen. So
What are they doing? Are they doing a specific like recruitment campaign? Like they have a plan to recruit these women?
Yeah, a bit. What are they sent me an email, I think about a week ago, because I think I said I want to do this, and they said, "Well, we saw you wanted to do this, so we're saving you a spot." You mm-hmm. know, and I think that they're going to try to save 100 spots for women until they're filled, instead of just a general registration of first come, first served.
Oh, yeah. Because it's probably a race that fills up pretty quickly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And it's not just like a race in Europe. This is like a huge race where it goes from like northern France all the way to Istanbul, Turkey.
Oh my.
Yeah, of course. All of Europe.
It's just like Lael to kind of like make it seem like not a big deal.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how long is this going to take?
I think the race is like, well, that's the cool thing. You make your own route. It's the transcontinental race. So there's like 85 checkpoints. And then you design a route to link up the checkpoints. And the checkpoints are like on the top of mountains. So you have to go up there, which is great for me, because that's the kind of riding I like to do. Uh-huh. And I think it ends up, you know, the routes usually end up being like 2,000 to 2,500 miles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what do you think some things we could do to get women into biking? I mean, I know there's lots of groups, and actually we should talk about grit, of course, because, you know, that's kind of a natural way to get girls started early, I think, is probably what's important. But what do you think the barriers are for women? I mean, for me, having come from this field of coaching, I mean, a big barrier, I think, is women just aren't comfortable with the mechanics of a bike. And so that's kind of number one a lot of times, is that women still don't have a culture of mechanics. We don't work with our hands on pieces of machinery. Now, not all women, I'm not saying all women, but generally that's kind of our culture.
Right.
And even when you're out riding, and I'm sure this has happened to you, like if you're stopped with a mechanical issue, there's always lots of times somebody coming by, a guy who thinks that you can't handle that mechanical issue and they're going to fix it for you, right? I mean, I've had that happen to me for sure.
Totally. Well, the thing I found in your experience with this too, is if I don't know exactly the reasons why women aren't in these mixed start lines, but if you create women specific events, they show up like crazy.
Yes. You know,
that's like the Gold Nugget Triathlon.
Right.
I mean, it's incredible participation, and it's like people that don't even know how to swim.
Yeah.
It's fine because they just want to be there and do this thing, you mm-hmm. know? So I found that, and actually about a week ago, yesterday, we wrapped up our 8th women's rally, and we do these bike packing rallies that are about 400, 450 miles over 8 days, pretty challenging route. And then we all start together, and then the only goal is to make it to the finisher's party at the end.
Uh-huh.
And so you're like, women carry their own gear, but, you know, we have this group of 50 or 60, and they kind of form smaller groups or leapfrog one another, make plans together where to camp, where to eat, where to do all this stuff. And then throughout the week, they start telling me stories about, oh, before this ride, I'd never ridden more than 42 miles.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And we had an age range this year that was like 21 to 65.
Oh, my gosh. That is just fantastic.
It was so awesome. And I think bikepacking, even more than cycling, is harder to get into because it's so gear intensive. You know, you need a bike, you need the bike packing bags, you need camping equipment, you need, you know, a computer to navigate with, and all these other components. And I don't tell them exactly what to bring, or, you know, make a list or say what's the best, and then you see what they show up with, and they figured it out somehow. You know, my husband was like, I borrowed everything I brought. And she did it, and it was fine, you know. Or you see this huge range of bikes. One woman was riding a mountain bike from like, I don't know, probably like 1989.
Wow.
This is so cool. She's like pushing this thing up the backside of Mount Lemmon, which is super rough.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't make it easy because I was like, I want them to see the beautiful stuff in this area, mm-hmm. you know, and you don't get to see it unless you go up high. So.
Right.
That kind of stuff, it's like every time I do something like that, I learn new things. But, you know, and this was the 8th over 4 years. And the first one I hosted in Europe, and it was, you know, the first time, and I put it together in 6 weeks. So I invited all kinds of people I knew, and most of them had a lot of experience. Mm-hmm. And then I learned at the end, every single one of them was intimidated to show up.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not even a race. And I realized this is a thing where it's like you have to kind of set that this is a welcoming space, that we're here to help each other. And then if you do that, you create kind of this rolling community where it's like, if there is a woman on the side of the road with a mechanical, it's another woman that stops. Mm-hmm. And maybe they don't know exactly how to fix it, but they work it out together. And that's unusual. You know,
yeah.
It is, a guy shows up and like pulls the tool out of your hand.
Yeah, it's right. Hard, exactly.
It's hard to learn if that always happens.
Mm-hmm. You know? Exactly.
And sometimes you have to learn on the road. It's just, you know, it's like a more practical situation where it's like, uh-oh. You know, and mm-hmm. then you put 3 plugs into the tire and say a little prayer. And
yeah.
Hope it holds, you know. But I mean, it was that good. It's so I think the thing is, I don't know. I'm not encouraging people to race either because it's so crazy. But I do think a lot of people want to go out on some kind of adventure. And I do think there's something about making this stuff challenging. It's a lot. The other thing is, a lot of the women's specific events are for beginners, no drop, you know, but then you don't kind of, it's less memorable.
Yeah. You
know, like having some kind of grit in it makes a difference.
So one of the things that I saw that kind of reminds me of when you were on the Trans Am bike race, which you won, you were the first woman ever to win it, and you know, raced to the very end against this guy, but you had a problem with your electronic shifting, and then you sneakily hid behind a gas station to fix it in case he came by and you didn't want him to see you. Yeah. I thought that was great.
You know, I was like, oh no, he's going to see me and then he's going to think I can win it. And yeah. So I get back there, and then the shifter battery was in like my seat or my seat post.
Oh.
And then I was like trying to get this thing out, and I got like another, I had a spare battery, so I connected it, but the other one was still in the frame. So I just jammed them both in there. That's the thing, is like, actually, you know, and I think maybe this is part of the problem, is often women really lack confidence just to make it work. And the thing with bike mechanicals is usually they're not catastrophic unless you can't keep air in your tires. But a lot of the stuff, you can ride a pretty broken bike.
Yeah.
One woman in the rally, like, she broke 2 spokes in a rear wheel, and we still had like 100 miles to go. And she's like, well, what do I do? And I was like, well, I think you could just ride it. You know, it's not going to feel great, and you're going to have to get it rebuilt later, but it's not going to, like, it's not your front wheel that could lock up in your frame and cause you to go over the handlebars. It's the rear. So as long as the wheel's still clearing the frame, it might be pretty wobbly, but you know, what else are you going to do? You're in the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
So she did. And I was at the end, I was like, oh, how'd it go? She's like, yeah, it's fine.
Yeah. It all worked out. You gained a lot of your mechanical skills because you worked at a bike shop, right?
Yeah, but initially, I didn't work in the back. I was just selling bikes.
Oh, yeah. It's rare to see women in the back. There are a couple of women in Anchorage in the back, but it's rare.
Also, yeah, I know. There's some really great female mechanics in Anchorage.
Yeah.
But, you know, I never loved it.
Oh.
I just do it because I have to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is fine, you know, and I can do like simple things, and if I have to, I do what I can to fix my bikes, but I don't build my own bikes.
Mm-hmm.
No way. Yeah. You know, I don't have like the fine tuning for that.
That's a lot of work to build your own bike. It takes a lot of time, doesn't it?
Yeah. And some people love it. You know, really, I just love riding it.
One of the things that you talked about there's a really good TED talk, and you talk about, it's a TED Talk Anchorage, and you talk about Trans Am bike race that we were just talking about, but you also made the point that this is in the ultra events in swim, bike, and run, women can win those against men.
Totally.
And I think there's this narrative out there that all women will get beat by all men. And it's just not true, especially in these ultra events where women have an advantage. Talk about your experience there in ultra, because I know that you've surprised men, but you're not the only woman who's out there winning these ultra bike races. And we know women are winning ultra runs and ultra swims.
Totally. And I mean, I think, well, you get to a start line and you're, you know, one of five women out of like a group of 200. So first of all, it's definitely a hard chance that one of the five women is going to win the race overall. There just aren't that many of them. But you're lined up against all these guys who look like, you know, super tough, super fit, ready to go. And I think to myself, oh, there's no way I could beat them. But then I think the reality is, how I usually break it down with races anyway, is I'm trying to get the most miles done per day. And so if I stick to my focus and I get those miles done per day, I could end up first.
You know, so you go in a plan, like it's like an Iditarod musher plan, like, okay, if I do this, if I execute it this way, I should be able to win it.
Right. And you give yourself some leniency with, you know, the all the problems you're going to have along the way. But like around the world, I said, okay, I'm going to try to hit 170 miles a day. And if I do that, then I'll finish in 110 days because I'm going to lose a couple days from flying and that kind of thing. So then I was like, focus on just kind of hitting that. But it seems kind of similar for, you know, something like the Tour Divide from Canada to Mexico. It's like, I'm trying to hit 185 miles a day. And if I do that, I'll finish this ride in 14 days. So I think like the thing is, instead of thinking, oh, I'm not as strong as these guys, you focus on what you're trying to achieve personally. And then that's how you get it done. Because like, gosh, to try to conceive of what it's going to be like to be out there for 2 weeks, I think is almost impossible. For me, I have to stick to one day at a time, or else I would just get totally overwhelmed.
Yeah. I can imagine also having such a long event takes away a little bit of the nervousness at the beginning, because it's just like so long. So you're not burning off a lot of that, you know, nervous energy.
Right. Like I'm going to mess it up by messing up the start. Sometimes I think, oh, I could probably be like an hour late and it would. I mean, you don't want to be, you know, because you want every minute that you can get. That's another one I used to tell myself, is like every minute counts the same as every other minute. You know, so everybody goes off like a gunshot for like the first 2 hours, but it's like, well, the 2 hours after that are the same, and the 2 hours after that are the same. Like it's all the same for your elapsed time.
You're very famous for also riding to the start of these very long races. So you also have to kind of plan that to make sure you, I mean, if you got there an hour late, fine. But if you get there a day late, that's a whole different thing, right?
Totally. And I mean, the last time, I think I overdid it. I rode like 4,000 miles to the start of the Tour Divide. And I was...
That's crazy. That is really, really
exhausted. And I think I had like 3 days off before the race. And, you know, I was kind of ground down. So I kind of learned from that. I was like, okay, maybe 2,000 miles would have been better.
Yeah.
You know, that was a little too much. But the problem is, it's like, I had so much fun during that ride that it was like, I was having the time of my life just getting up there.
Yeah.
I didn't have like any reserves for the actual race. So I'm kind of trying to find some kind of balance, but it is a great way to train. You know, you have your equipment, and spending that much time in the saddle actually helps so much, because then I'm not uncomfortable to do it during the race.
Right. Do a lot of the racers who show up are just like kind of recreational people? I mean, this is your life, and so they're training for a certain amount of time, but not train, like your life is like, I'm always moving year round, every day, right?
Yeah.
And are they just doing, taking like chunks of time, like when you train for an Ironman, it lasts 6 months or whatever?
I think some are starting to do this kind of like ride to the start thing like me, which is cool. I saw like, you know, a dozen people do that for that Tour Divide. And that's so cool, because they get this adventure out of it. They're like, I started my ride in Utah. I started my ride in Oregon. And I thought, oh, that's cool. And imagine that like kind of swarm of people coming together. Other people, I think, do more kind of structural scientific training. So like intervals, and, you know, they have a plan and they stick to that.
Right.
Works for them. But then I think it works, but also I think they experience more discomfort and pain during the actual event. Just because it's like not in the field, you know, you end up with like terrible saddle sores because you've been riding 16 hours a day.
That's makes sense awful. To me that, yeah, because on the bike, you're on there for so long for such an extended period of time and there's all these pressure points. So if you're just not doing that, just have your butt on a seat year round,
right.
then yeah, you're not going to know until you actually start doing those days.
Right. Or it's like, you know, trying to find decent food at the gas station.
Yeah.
Oh, God. But maybe it's better not to train too much of that.
Yeah.
So depressing. Maybe you're excited to eat a bunch of candy bars or something if you only do it for, you know, a week out of the year.
I'm imagining, I was thinking about this earlier today, you have to be, by the time you get to the end of those rides, like, I just want fresh food.
Totally. Yeah. Usually Rue comes to the finish and makes me like a pasta and vegan meatball or something like real and like homemade. Yep. And I'm just like, oh, thank God.
It tastes so good. Do you have food fantasies as you're going? Because you're like getting used to all this. Oh, you don't?
I'm just like, no more food.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's like too much. Like you're just like forcing it in by that point to keep yourself going. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm like, no, I don't want anything. And then, of course, like 10 minutes later, I'm like, I am starving.
Yeah.
I'm so kind of emotionally dependent on food. Like, I'm like, oh, I'm exhausted. And then I eat something and I like perk up. Like, I just had a cup of coffee.
Oh, it's amazing, isn't it? Whenever I'm tired, I'm like, I really probably just need to eat.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah. You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. We are going to take a short break, and when we return, the conversation with Lael Wilcox and Rue Calladite will continue.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
You're listening to Alaska Public Media on KSKA Anchorage, FM 91.1, connecting Alaskans, life informed.
Artists need time and space to be creative, but for emerging artists, it can be difficult to do while also earning a living. A new fellowship created by Yupik and Inupiaq mass carver Drew Michael aims to give Indigenous artists in the North time to grow their skills and create art at the Anchorage Museum. We'll discuss the Drew Michael Artist Fellowship on the next Alaska Insight.
Friday night at 7 on Alaska Public Media Television.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. My conversation with ultra-endurance biker Lael Wilcox and professional photographer Rue Calladite continues. So Rue, I want to hear a little bit from you, of course, but like the big, well, I have two questions. And so the number one is, how did the two of you meet?
Yeah, so I have a background in photojournalism. That's what I studied in college. And I did a couple newspaper internships, one in Victoria, Texas, and one in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and then I landed a staff position at Anchorage Daily News. And I grew up in Chicago, and I always just dreamed of, you know, going somewhere out west, and Alaska was always kind of like the top of the list. And I started working there in January of 2017, and around springtime, I think I saw Lael post something on her Instagram at the time about her doing this girls mentorship program. So, and it was called Anchorage Grit, Girls Riding to Tomorrow. And I remember, I think I called the bicycle shop where you worked. Yeah, because I think that was like your contact information and just said, you know, I'm working for the newspaper. I'd love to do kind of an extended story on your girls program. It's the first year of it. It's, you know, what do you think? And I documented, well, she said yes. She said that's cool. And for 6 weeks on and off, they would meet. So I guess a little bit about Anchorage Grit. It's this mentorship program for 7th and 8th grade girls, and over the course of 6 weeks, they train to ride. Do you want to talk about it?
Yeah,
they like talking about it, but that's how we met. So I pitched a story, it got approved, and maybe you want to talk about Anchorage Grit a little bit.
Yeah, so they work up to riding from Bagage Middle School out to Serenity Falls Forest Service Cabin at the end of Aklutna Lake, which is a rugged ride.
Yes, it is.
45 miles to get out there and then another 12 miles to get back to the parking lot. And before the program, none of them had ridden more than 5 miles. Most of them hadn't ridden more than two.
Wow. And some of them probably didn't have bikes, right?
No. So we provide the bikes.
Oh,
so
okay. But before that, they didn't have bikes. They had never biked before.
Actually, for the first 3 years, they all knew how to ride.
Okay. That's a bonus.
I've run it for a couple years in Tucson, and that was the first time I encountered a girl that came to the program but didn't know how to ride.
Wow.
Like, oh my gosh. Okay. We've got to teach this girl how to ride. And she learned. And then a month later, she rode out 25 miles out to do a camp out.
That is so crazy.
Kids really can learn stuff quickly. And, you know, if they're driven, they improve so quickly. Mm-hmm. So cool.
Yeah.
So that's how Rue and I met. And then she was, you know, she's a fly on the wall. We didn't even really interact during the program. And then once she finished the video, I was no longer her subject. And I asked her to go for a bike ride. And she at that point said yes.
Yeah. And this is like, I mean, it was so much fun, right? You could get off work like at 10 o'clock and it's still daylight out. So you're like, oh, yeah, let's go for a bike ride. And this was the summer where Lil was riding all the major roads in Alaska. Mm-hmm. And I'm a cyclist, and I was a cyclist before I met Lil, but she invited me to go and ride the Denali Park Road with her. So we took a bus all the way to the end at that time, Wonder Lake. We took the bus, and then we rode to the end at Kentishna and then rode back out of the park. Like at 2 a.m., we're riding through the park, and it was so cool.
Great.
Yeah.
It was so fun.
And then I joined Lil for a few other rides that she did kind of closer to Anchorage and whatnot, and yeah.
And that was fun.
That's how we met.
And then now your role in all of this, because you guys have a real, just a, not only, you know, not only a marriage partnership, but a professional partnership, right? Because you're kind of documenting everything now.
Yeah, absolutely. So that same year, kind of at the end of the year, ADN, Anchorage Daily News, went bankrupt. So I was one of 70 employees that were laid off. And Lale and I both didn't have jobs at the time. And it was starting to get like winter in Alaska. And we thought, okay, well, either we find jobs or we find jobs somewhere else. And Lale's friend was opening up a restaurant in Austin, Texas. So we decided, oh, that'd be, you know, let's just do that for a bit.
Yeah.
And I drove from Alaska through Canada, and it was like the worst snowstorms ever, only doing maybe like 200 miles a day of driving. And Lale doesn't drive. So it was just.
Oh, yeah. So it was all on you. Yeah.
Yeah. So we made it down to Tucson, Arizona. Some friends were in town. So we got some tacos, rode up the local mountain at sunset. And then we did another ride the next morning up to an observatory. And then Lale just said, you know, we could always get like a restaurant job here in Tucson, Arizona. So that's what we did. We worked at a pizza place for a bit. We did some guiding south of Tucson. And then we started kind of working together, whereas I was documenting Lale's races, or kind of starting to. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of this unique blend of, you know, an event that Lale was doing and then kind of telling a story about it with partnerships of like cycling companies. So like at that time, the first video that we did was with Pearl Izumi Cycling Apparel Company, and it was a race in Switzerland.
Right. And Revelate Designs.
That's mm-hmm. right.
Yeah.
That's right.
We'll make sure that there's a link to your website, because all of these videos are on your website, and there's just some really just great videos. I mean, and pictures, and just the timeline that you have of everything that's happened in Lale's cycling career. And Rue, you've participated also not just like by documenting it, but by like the rallies. I see that you've done a lot of the rallies and the scouting of routes and stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
By the way, a side thing, my very favorite place to go in Tucson is American Eats and have the birria tacos there. Have you been there?
No.
Okay. Well, if you're a vegetarian, they're not vegetarian. So, but they are fantastic.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Well, I guess we should like get into the granddaddy of this, which is like we're going to talk about your world record of cycling around the world. So you had said that this idea had come to you like a long time ago, really, like in the teens, the 2000 teens, right?
Yeah, when I was biking down to the Trans Am. So I took the ferry from, I rode out to Haines and then took the ferry from Haines to Bellingham and then rode the rest of the way down to Astoria, Oregon. And while I was riding down to the start, I thought, what if the ride across the country was the start of my ride around the world? And, you know, as a big dreamer, and all I did was get a new passport. That's it. And then
that's a start, Lael.
Yeah, that's a start. I raced across the country and then I was so cooked. I was like, oh, no way. I am so sick of riding and I need a break. So I didn't continue then. But I guess it was always kind of in the back of my mind since then. And then after that, the next spring, actually, a guy, Mike Hall, this kind of iconic racer, was doing a race across Australia on the road and got hit by a car and killed. And it kind of reset my mind for a while where I thought I should get off the road. Mm. You know, it's too dangerous. The risk's too high. I don't want to be that person. I don't want my family to go through that. So then I switched to riding basically all dirt, either gravel or mountain bike, and racing, and that just felt a bit safer. Then I kind of came back to it. I think it was probably 2022. Somebody asked me to do a 900-mile road race in Spain. It was the first time I'd been on the road really for a long race. And it was in Catalonia where the drivers treat cyclists like royalty.
Oh,
you know,
wow.
They're super patient. They get all the way into the other lane to pass. And it was awesome. And I loved being back on the road. And so I was kind of getting back into it. And then I did that 4,000-mile ride to the start of the Tour Divide. And I was on road again. And I was having so much fun. I thought, this is so easy. You know, it's like everything you put into the bike, you get back out of it. It's like flying. And I just was enjoying that so much that I decided I'm gonna go after it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like I have an open season in 2024. And I'm going to see if I can put it together. And you know, my main thing was trying to make it as safe as possible because you make your own route for this. So picking.
So how does that work?
Yeah. So you have to, there's like a basic set of rules, 18,000 mile minimum, east or west. You cross two opposite sides of the globe. So for me, it was Madrid, Spain, and Wellington, New Zealand. You can't like zigzag back and forth. You have to take commercial travel between points, continuous clock. I think that's about it. Mm-hmm. So really the route was up to me. And so I asked some good friends for help on, you know, making a safe route across Europe, Australia, New Zealand. And then I felt pretty confident with Alaska and Canada. And then I followed Adventure Cycling Association routes down the west coast of the U.S. and then back up through Route 66 to Chicago. Mm-hmm. And they were good. You know, in the end, my ride was like 630,000 feet of climbing. really crazy. You know, it's just because I went across the Alps, I went across the Balkans.
Oh my gosh.
I just did so much climbing because I also like that kind of riding, but it's definitely not the fastest. But I thought I'm gonna be out there for at least 3.5 months. Mm-hmm. I want to enjoy this. You know, I don't just want to be on like the flattest, fastest route. Mm-hmm. So it worked out. I wore like a high-vis vest and I had a bunch of lights and I invited people to come ride with me. So, and this was, I mean, the most fun part of the whole thing was I said, anybody can come for any part of it. And so in the end, I think I had about 3,000 different people come for.
Oh my gosh.
And they'd pop up all over the place, just like on the side of the road or riding towards me, or like a group would be at the other side of a ferry.
So how did those people know that you were going to be there?
I had a tracker. So I had a tracking page on Rafa's website and then I, you know, share my route so they could kind of guess, when I would make it.
Uh-huh. And so they were just like, oh, we think she's getting, oh, we can see her on this ferry. We know this ferry is going to land at this time. We better be there.
Right. And meanwhile, they're making their own like little social groups, like guessing which ferry they think I might take. So they can coordinate being there. And I had, you know, some of the time I was like, ferry, what ferry?
Yeah.
But I didn't really look ahead. You know, I was like, oh, well, I'll figure stuff out when I get there. You know?
Yeah.
So that was so much fun. You know, all ages, all countries. And then sometimes, you know, they didn't come to ride, but they just come out and cheer. And, you know, I had like older folks in New Zealand and the Netherlands, like with cowbells on the side of the road in the dark.
Oh, wow. Wow. Oh, you know, so heartwarming.
So kind.
Yes.
People got so excited because they're like, you're passing through my tiny town in Ohio. You know, and that's so cool.
Good.
It just brought so much life to the route for me.
But for the record, I did go to Speedway and try to see you the day you were here. And I had to be somewhere and I waited for a little while and then you hadn't gotten there yet. So I did try to.
Thanks for trying.
Yes, I tried. I did try. I really wanted to see you. I was really excited. But you had a big crowd leaving Anchorage. You had a lot of people show up and it was not a nice day either. It was kind of
rainy.
And, yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
Oh, but that was the best flying back into Anchorage.
Because I'd been
through winter in Australia and New Zealand. And I was like, you know, a bunch of snow in New Zealand. It was like 19 degrees in the mornings.
Oh, wow.
And then I fly back to Anchorage and it's August and it's still summer and light until 11. It was like the best feeling in the world. And I was in a familiar place again. So that really turned it around for me.
So a lot of your races are self-supported. So talk a little bit. This was, you could get as much support as you needed, and you could sleep wherever you wanted to sleep and and have a homemade meal, all of those things, right?
Totally. So that kind of made it nice.
Yeah.
So when I set out to do this first, I thought, I was scheming this and I thought, I'll just do it by myself because it's so long. I kind of didn't want to put Rue through that. It's just being on the road for, you know, we were out there for 108 days, just slugged everything out. And then the more I talked about it, the more it was like, I think I want to be there. I want to document this.
Yeah.
And so you did.
Yeah. We ended up doing a daily podcast. So every single day we would record a podcast, kind of just talking about like, you know, like day one, where the start and end point was for each day, the distance, and then just kind of a reflection on the day. And Lil's like, well, I kind of want to do this because I'm not going to remember what I did a week ago.
Yeah.
Right? Like 100 days of experiences, but each week kind of feels like a few months, right? Because it's so saturated. So we did that, documented photos that we shared on Lil's Instagram and her website, and we're making a final video to showcase it all.
Oh, yeah. I was going to ask about that. I assumed that was going to come out at some point. When do you think it's going to be ready?
We're hoping to do some screenings beginning of next year, and then it'll be available to the public on YouTube.
So,
yeah, nothing set yet. But, you know, Lil's carrying all the gear that she needed to have on her bike, just because my job wasn't to help her, but it was just to kind of document this and to share her story. And it's kind of funny. You're like, this is the grandfather of like your, you know, your career. And then it is like such an incredible thing that Lil did, but she's already like, all right, this is what I'm doing next year. She's already like scheming for,
of course.
You know, it's like life goes on. This isn't like the only thing that she's ever done or will do.
But
it's
unique.
It was so unique.
It was unique because a lot of the racing I do, it's like you can't really
interact
with other people.
Yeah.
Like, you don't have to pretend like you're out there alone and you can't like for instance, for this ride, people would come out and they'd bring me cookies or they'd make me a sandwich or something like that. And it just felt so good to be able to accept it. It's like, this is awesome. Or to have people ride next to me. The one thing I couldn't do, I couldn't have them in front because I couldn't get like a wind protection.
Right.
Then in the end, people would just draft off me. Sometimes I'd be riding into kind of a brutal headwind and then, you know, these big guys would just be behind me having a conversation.
Hope you're enjoying the ride, guys.
So cool. But yeah, and then if it worked out and like, you know, they invited me to stay in their home and the distance was right, I could stay at somebody's house or, you know, I could have a friend work on my bike or that kind of thing. So it felt more kind of normal in a way. I mean, I don't know if that experience could ever feel normal, but it felt like a little more human. I stopped and visited a couple friends in Switzerland and that was just cool. You know, it's cool to get to do that.
And it's nice from like a video standpoint too. It's not like it is Lil a lot of the time solo, just going through the elements
half the time.
But then it's like, well, there's like a beauty in that and like this athletic feat. But then also it's like, well, you're inspiring others to come out with you. You know, some people would ride for like 5 minutes. They'd get off work and their scrubs and be riding, or they'd hang on for like 10 hours after driving 5 hours to meet Lil. Yeah. It was just like, all these different characters, and you just never knew who was going to be there. It's like, well, I'll be riding, and she'd see someone that was riding the opposite direction, and she's like, oh, just a cyclist. But then you see that person turn around, join her.
That's great.
But even though I was documenting the whole thing, we would see entirely different things as well, because I'd be know, in a car setting up a shot and then waiting, and then I'd hear about like all these people that came out to see her, because a lot of the times, you know, if you're 10 miles ahead or something, these spectators are there in their car or in their home and they're following this dot, this tracking dot, and they'll just pop out with all these signs or these goodies and you know, the only way to kind of see all that was if I was riding next to Lil. So I had an e-bike at times and I'd be kind of shooting from the bike, and it was just like
so much fun.
So maybe it's like, it is like your biggest project you've ever done. But then I'm like, well, mine's just beginning with the editing.
Yeah.
This might be my grandfather project and then I'm done shooting forever.
You're over.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing that has made you so successful in a lot of these races is that your ability to not sleep or sleep very little, right? Yeah. And here you got all the sleep. You really are you kind of 7 hours was your thing, right? Yeah.
I actually recovered.
Yeah.
Where I felt fresh the next day and excited to get back out there. And also physically, I could ride so much faster.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't just totally cooked.
Uh-huh.
It was like a revelation.
Yeah.
and then I got to really enjoy it a lot more than feeling sleep deprived or feeling kind of crummy, you know, because I think it's really that lack of sleep that everything starts to break down. You know, your mouth gets kind of sore, your stomach's sore, and just your ability to make decisions isn't as good. And you can't ride as fast. You just don't have the same power. So I thought, how can I use this in the shorter races I do? Or finding like, you know, before I thought 4 hours was enough and maybe it's more like six. You know, can I make up those 2 hours in the day by riding faster? It's something to definitely experiment a bit more with. Because also then it's just a lot more fun too. It's more fun to feel more athletic.
Yeah. To feel power in your body.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And feel like, you know, you can change gears instead of just plugging along.
Yeah. That is going to be an interesting experiment, because I mean, the sleep thing I think would be very difficult for a lot of people if they were doing a race or whatever. Like the rally idea I like, because you get sleep on the rallies, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
But then the thing is, I think this whole around the world kind of worked as like this massive training block, because I'm riding faster now than I ever have.
Oh,
like
wow.
I rode El Tour de Tucson yesterday. It's 102 miles. I finished in 3 hours and 52 minutes.
Whoa.
That's like time travel.
Yes. That is so fast.
Like relative to like around the world, I averaged 15 miles an hour. This was 26 miles an hour.
Oh my gosh.
For a century, you know?
Wow.
It's crazy. I've just like, I think I've unlocked a new level of fitness I didn't know I had, just because I rode so much, but I actually like recovered while I rode. You know, and I was just consistent. I wasn't like going for like a burnout.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I don't know. It's something different where I'm like, oh, that's fun.
Uh-huh.
At least fun to be fit now, you know, and not ride for 12 hours every day.
Right. Yeah. Well, that does have to be kind of this roller coaster if you're used to like the around the world every day doing, you know, on your bike for this many hours, and then all of a sudden you're done. And maybe you're on your bike for just a couple hours a day. That's a huge difference.
Totally. And I I mean, I was really relieved to finish. It was so exciting to get there, but also just kind of, I didn't realize how much I thought like something could go horribly wrong.
Yeah.
You know, like I could get hit by a car or I could get really injured or something catastrophic could happen that would stop what I'm doing. So
Yeah.
to finish, I was like, okay, I'm finished. I
Yeah.
did it, you know, and then it was so nice to not feel kind of rushed and urgent all the time. So I
Yeah.
did have to kind of be efficient. Like I need to eat quickly, I need to shower, record the podcast, and then I need to sleep because I have to get the 7 hours and to be on like such a kind of a rigid system that I was like, oh, I can like take an hour to have lunch.
Yeah.
This is great, you know. But the thing I was surprised by was I wasn't sick of writing. I
Wow.
wanted to
That's
keep
amazing to me.
writing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I
That's
was like, I actually feel pretty good and I want to keep writing, but I was like, I'm not going to ride like 12 hours a day, but I'll ride like, you know, 6 hours up Mount Lemon
Yeah.
and like take the bags off my bike and just have fun, you know? So it's been really good. I think I finished like, gosh, a bit over 2 months ago, and it's just been fun to kind of not be on such a
A
linear
schedule.
path.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of people like appreciate that downtime once they're done with the big events like this. But definitely, I've never talked to anyone who had such a big event as you. This is really huge.
Oh, so good. I feel so grateful that I got to do it. You know, what a project. I can't
Yeah.
believe that we could put that together. I can't believe Rue was willing to come for it, and we got to see all those places together. You know, that's
Yes.
pretty special. We, you know, both got to cross Australia.
Oh man, yeah, that's amazing. I heard that there was a woman who was also riding at the same time as you.
Totally.
And that what I heard was she was on track for a record too, but I don't know how that finished out.
She's still riding.
Oh, wow.
Do you know kind of so her name's Mindagi. She's super great.
She's
She
super
lives in
cool.
Scotland. She was born in India. Is
Yes.
that correct? She started her ride in India, did a stretch, rode a little bit across, rode across Mongolia, and then did Australia, New Zealand. And she ended up having to go to South America because she couldn't get a visa for Canada and
Which is
States.
really tough.
And right now
Wow.
she is in Europe, and I want
It's
to, s
winter.
it's winter.
Wow. Oh,
Like
man.
I'm
Oh.
130 days in and just over halfway through her ride.
Okay. How many people have ridden around the world by these parameters?
I wonder because I think of probably a lot of people have just on bike trips, but you know, maybe
Yeah.
they took like 3 years, 5 years to do it, which is
Yeah.
awesome. What, like, I thought 3 months was a long time to be out there.
No,
But you know,
you have to now plan a 5-year project now, right?
can you imagine? Like, I can't even imagine setting out for something like that. You know, that's
Yeah.
crazy. But so I think, you know, probably a lot more people have done it than we know about. But I think for women, gosh, maybe five, six, something like
Wow.
that. Anne Vindaghi's somebody who's done it before. She rode
Oh,
around the world
wow.
when she was 19.
Oh my gosh.
And so then she wanted to come back and do it again and kind of, you know, give it another go. So I would hear from her. Sometimes she'll send me a message or we'll exchange messages. And it was just cool to know someone else was out there doing it, you know? So cool that we're both doing it the same summer.
Yeah. I mean, just more women out there. That's great. I
Totally.
mean,
With different stories and different
yep.
approaches. And so that was awesome.
Yeah. Well, this has been a fantastic conversation. I could keep talking to you forever. Thanks so much for taking this time today, and it's been really a pleasure talking to both of you.
Yeah, absolutely. Good to talk with you.
That's it for today's show. Thanks to my guests, Lael Wilcox and Rue Calladite. You can find out more about Lael's bike journeys on the Outdoor Explorer page on alaskapublic.org. The show is produced by Tobin Shelby with help from Ammon Swenson. My name is Lisa Keller, and from all of our hosts here at Outdoor Explorer, thanks for listening, and we'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.
Programming on KSDP is supported by the Schumigan Corporation. Located in Sand Point, the Schumigan family of businesses includes property and equity management, the Sand Point Tavern, the Anchor Inn Motel, and the Anchor Inn Lounge. The Schumigan Corporation, serving its shareholders and the people of Sand Point, on the web at www.schumigan.com or by telephone at 907-383-3525. The Schumigan Corporation, hometown values and service, a proud sponsor of KSDP.
KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sand Point, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cole.